From Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, China begins separatism trial of Uyghur scholar. South China Sea dispute tests Philippines' ties with China. Hear what you should know about China's economy from one of the best experts. These stories and more in this Thursday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. China has begun its trial of ethnic Uyghur scholar Ilham Todi, a widely regarded academic who has also openly criticized China's ethnic policies in the remote region of Xinjiang. Chinese authorities have charged the former economics professor with separatism, an accusation Todi denies. VOA's Bill Ide has more from Beijing.
Security was tight outside the court in Xinjiang's capital of Urumqi, where the trial of Ilham Todi was held. Much like his arrest earlier this year, details about the proceedings were limited. It is unclear when a sentence will be announced. Foreign journalists were not allowed inside the Urumqi People's Intermediate Court, and police formed a barricade around the building. Western diplomats were also kept away from the proceedings. European Union diplomat Rafael Drazewski was among those who tried to attend the trial. He spoke with reporters outside the courtroom.
We are here today because we would like to attend the trial of Ilham Todi. We've already expressed our concern over his indictment, and especially because Mr. Todi worked peacefully within Chinese laws for years, especially to promote a good relationship between minorities in China and for equal rights.
A U.S. embassy spokesman says Todi's arrest silenced an important Uyghur voice that peacefully promoted harmony and understanding among China's ethnic groups, particularly Uyghurs. The spokesman said the United States has stressed to Chinese authorities the importance of differentiating between peaceful dissent and violent extremism. U.S. Ambassador Max Baucus is also in Xinjiang this week, leading a trade delegation to the region on a previously scheduled trip. While there, he will meet with Xinjiang officials. The United States, the European Union, and several rights groups have called for Chinese authorities to release Todi, as well as several of his students who were detained earlier this year. Little is known about the whereabouts of his students. Before his arrest in January, Todi told VOA that plainclothes police rammed his car, took his phone, and threatened to kill him because of his comments to the media. At a hearing in Washington, D.C. earlier this year, hosted by the Congressional Executive Commission on China, his daughter testified Chinese authorities have persecuted her family. Todi's daughter, Juher Ilham, is studying in the United States at Indiana University.
Anyone who knows my father realizes how false these charges are. My father never speaks about separatism. By arresting my father, China has driven Uyghurs to understand that their justified grievances can't get any sort of hearing.
Todi has written about the Chinese government's policies toward ethnic Uyghurs for years, but came under increasing scrutiny over the past year or so as China saw a dramatic spike in violence blamed on extremists. Todi has long questioned the government's official narrative when it comes to violent attacks that authorities brand as acts of terrorism. He has consistently argued that more transparency and facts are needed to understand the motives behind the attacks China is facing. China blames the unrest on religious extremists and the East Turkestan Islamic Movement, which it says is conspiring to carve out an independent state in the region. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
Stay with Daybreak Asia to hear Nicholas Lardy, one of the preeminent economic experts on China. This week, a huge trade show opens in Nanning, China, focusing on promoting ties between Southeast Asian countries and their biggest trading partner, China. However, for the second year in a row, the Philippine president is not attending, following another tense year in the South China Sea. From Manila, Simone Orendain reports how the territorial dispute is reshaping the two countries' broader relationship.
Philippine Foreign Affairs spokesman Charles Jose says an agreement in 2011 between President Benigno Aquino and then-President Hu Jintao is what guides Manila's relations with Beijing.
both countries should not let the territorial dispute affect the overall relationship. So on the part of the Philippines, we are willing to extract and isolate our territorial dispute and deal with this separately. But at the same time, we try to promote and strengthen the other areas of our cooperation with China.
3 years ago, there was no Scarborough Shoal standoff and no pending case at the Permanent Court of Arbitration in The Hague. At the time, the Philippines had only filed a string of diplomatic protests against China, which claims indisputable sovereignty over practically the entire South China Sea. In 2012, China effectively took control of Scarborough after a tense months-long standoff between vessels of the two countries in waters within the Philippines' exclusive economic zone. A year later, Manila filed an arbitration case questioning China's sweeping claims in the resource-rich sea. Beijing rejects arbitration and has not responded to the case. Last year, the Philippines was the designated country of honor at the China-ASEAN Expo in Nanning. But Philippine officials say President Aquino was uninvited because of the arbitration filing. The Chinese embassy in Manila declined a formal interview request from VOA to discuss the relationship. Romel Banlawi is executive director of Manila-based Philippine Institute for Peace, Violence and Terrorism Research. He says the sea dispute is hindering relations.
It's still in a very sour political state. The relationship is still at its lowest point.
Still, the foreign affairs spokesman says trade and tourism between the two countries remain strong. Official Philippines data shows that in the past 3 years, tourism arrivals from China increased, with a 70% jump from 2012 to 2013. Last year, 426,000 of the country's 4.6 million tourists came from China. Banlawi calls the tourism increase minuscule and says Manila has been losing out on Beijing's ability to aggressively promote international travel. Besides, he says, more Filipinos invest in China than the other way around.
The Philippines would have been one of the major destinations of China's investments in Southeast Asia. China has this policy of maritime Silk Road. Well, the Maritime Silk Road aims to intensify China-Southeast Asia economic relationship through increased investments and through enhanced trade and commercial relationship. The Philippines is not part of that.
Manlawi points out neighboring Singapore, Indonesia, Malaysia, and other countries in the region are participating. While ships from the two countries jockey for position in remote islands of the South China Sea, and officials in the capitals keep up the heated rhetoric, some analysts say the situation will largely remain the same, mostly because of the Aquino administration's push to expand its military relationship with Washington. Renato De Castro of De La Salle University in Manila says the relationship is viewed skeptically in Beijing.
For them, President Aquino and Foreign Secretary Belisario are basically pro-Americans. That's how they view it. They're puppets. They're manipulated by the United States. If they are removed, if they are gone, everything will go well.
De Castro says China is simply waiting out the end of Aquino's term in 2016 in hopes of returning to normal relations with the Philippines. But he says right now, Manila is doing a poor job of balancing its ties to both superpowers. Simone Orendain for VOA News, Manila.
There is always so much news from Asia and never seems to be enough time to discuss it all. That's why we have more on our website at voanews.com. Stop by our Asia page after today's program. A controversial bill that would abolish direct elections for local mayors and governors in Indonesia is drawing strong criticism in the world's third largest democracy. Critics say laudable democratic gains made over the past decade would be curtailed under the proposed law. Kate Lamb has this report from Jakarta.
Just 2 months after Indonesia elected former small-town mayor and later Jakarta governor Joko Widodo to be their next president, the country's parliament is considering abolishing direct elections at the local level. If approved, the bill would see local mayors and governors elected by political parties rather than directly by the people. Direct elections for regional leaders have been in place since 2005 and have been credited with generating a handful of visionary three new leaders, including President-elect Widodo. But advocates of the proposed new law say direct local elections are inefficient, costly and foster corruption. Fadli Zon, vice chairman of the Gerindra Party, told a panel discussion in Jakarta on Wednesday why his party is backing the bill.
There's a heavy campaign burden. I think at least the cost of the campaign in each pilkada or regional election, direct election, is 30 to 35 billion. And I think this is only expense of the election committee. We're not talking about the campaign expenses, the witness expenses, the success team and all so on.
Zon says the total cost of directly electing mayors and governors at the local level amounts to $5 billion US dollars. As candidates routinely hand out bribes to win a seat, in some cases exhausting their entire life savings to be elected, advocates say abolishing direct elections would curb graft and the numbers of cases of electoral fraud heard by the Constitutional Court. While critics agree that Indonesia's somewhat boisterous democracy is expensive to fund, they argue that reducing the capacity of people to directly elect their local leaders would undermine the country's political progress. Sawono Kusuma Admaja, a senior advisor for government affairs at the public policy group Transformasi, says the proposed law would benefit existing party structures.
It doesn't change the nature of politics. It won't make politics any cleaner, no. It will only shift the money politics somewhere else to the oligarchs. And the victims are the Indonesian people.
After former dictator Suharto stepped down in 1998, Indonesia has embarked on a comprehensive process of reform and decentralization. Each election that has followed has seen Indonesian voters become increasingly engaged and political debates more substantive. When President-elect Widodo is inaugurated this October, it will be the first time that power has been handed from one directly elected leader to another in Indonesia, a claim that cannot be made by regional neighbours Malaysia, Singapore and Cambodia. Within Southeast Asia, Indonesia is now being hailed as a democratic success story. Critics have also criticised the timing of the push to pass this bill, just weeks before Mr. Widodo, who opposes the bill, comes into office. The final vote may come down to outgoing President Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono, who must approve the legislation before it becomes law. In a recorded statement posted on YouTube, President Yudhoyono did not come out harshly against the bill, but he did say direct elections should be maintained. Lawmakers are expected to vote on the proposed law on September 25. For VOA News, this is Kate Lamb, Jakarta.
The world's largest survey of coastal trash has found that illegal dumping is a main source of the rubbish found on beaches in Australia. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Researchers combed the vast Australian coastline at intervals of about 100 kilometres and have compiled the world's largest collection of data on marine trash. The survey was orchestrated by Australia's Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organisation and involved conservation groups and petroleum giant Shell. Students, teachers, scientists and employees of Shell were enlisted to comb beaches around the country as part of the three-year project. Their work rejects the notion that debris washed up on the Australian coast is the result of ocean currents bringing trash from other countries. The report states that littering and illegal dumping causes the majority of coastal debris in Australia. And co-author Dr. Chris Wilcox says the problem is worse nearer metropolitan areas.
As you get closer to a city along the coastline, you see more and more stuff. It's not necessarily just people leaving it on the beach. It's also getting transported out through stormwater drains and then into creeks and down the creeks into rivers and into the bays. So you can see the plume of debris along the coastline and offshore as you approach Sydney. If you spend any time on ships and you want to guess whether you're close to a city or not, you just look over the side and start counting stuff.
The report said this marine debris posed not only a navigation hazard to shipping, but could also damage coral reefs and tourism while killing and injuring wildlife. The survey found that about 75% of the trash along the Australian coast is plastic. Researchers say the waste is having a devastating effect on seabirds. Smaller turtles also ingested the debris, possibly because soft, clear plastic resembled its natural prey, jellyfish. Australia is the world's driest inhabited continent and has around 50,000 kilometres of coastline. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney, Australia.
The dramatic rise of China's economy has come with dramatic shifts in the makeup of its economy. China's leadership has enacted various reforms over the past 30 years to move away from the dominance of state-owned companies and allow private enterprises to flourish and create a consistent growth of the economy, currently about 7.5% a year. Despite the trend, much of the economic reporting about China has remained centered on large state-owned companies. Nicholas Lardy of the Peterson Institute for International Economics says in his new book, Markets Over Mao, China has even more room to grow.
I've been following the Chinese economy for a long time, and I have been increasingly, if frustrated is the right word, but thinking that there is far too much emphasis in most of the commentary and coverage on China of big state companies. They are very big, some of them, and they do have a lot of influence in certain sectors and subsectors, but I thought we were missing the main story, which is that the private sector, private businesses, have been the major source of growth, almost the sole source of increase in employment, increasingly the major source of export growth. It's hard to cover that sector because there are about 6.6 million private companies. It's a lot easier to tell a story about Sinopec or China Mobile or, you know, one of the big state companies. But in the aggregate, their influence and contribution to China's economic growth has really faded dramatically.
How do you go about covering a story like that and digging into some of these smaller privately owned companies and finding the trends and the big pictures out of it?
We have better and better data on China from every major government ministry, and even a lot of minor ones have websites that provide a great deal of data. I think the effort of having a kind of a state-directed economy have, over the last 10 years, has basically failed. Their productivity has gone down, their share of profits is down, and most importantly, the return on assets, what they're actually earning, is substantially less than their cost of capital, which is, you know, not a very strong recommendation for a successful industrial policy.
In the West, we look at large companies quite often. In fact, our stock market indices are based on some of the largest companies there are. The economy is driven by a lot of smaller companies and mom-and-pop stores, privately held enterprises. Is this a parallel with China?
I think China is an even stronger case because the number of listed companies is very small. It's only about 2,000 in China. It's about 5,000 in the U.S., but 2,000 out of the total number of Chinese companies is a much smaller representation than 5,000 is in the U.S. So the extent to which the success or failure of listed companies is indicative of broader trends in the economy is probably much stronger for the United States than it is for China.
We have tended over quite a long period of time to look at the Chinese economy as a state capitalism model where the government controls so much of it. What do you have to say about the notion of state capitalism in relation to the picture that you see it as?
I think the notion that China is a state capitalist economy is an exaggeration at best. The market is the decisive allocator of resources in China. The state has tried to intervene, but without much luck. The state is just not as dominant. If you take manufacturing, for example, when reform began in the late 70s, state companies were producing about 80% of all manufactured goods. Today, they're only producing 20%. So their footprint has shrunk. State companies today in urban China only employ about 13% of the workforce. This is a dramatic reduction from 20, 30 years ago when most people in urban China were working for state companies. Virtually everybody now is working for a private company.
What has led to the development and this rise of the private sector? What were some of the major forces that created this?
I think number one, and the most important, and one of the things I try to lay out carefully in the book, is that for the entire period, private companies have been more efficient. They have a higher, what economists call, return on assets. They're earning more on their capital stock than state companies. So their after-tax profits are higher, and most investment in China is financed with retained earnings. So if you have a higher return on capital, higher return on assets, then you're going to be able to build your business more rapidly. And that's what private companies have been able to do. So that's the most important thing. The second thing, which I think is a surprise to many people, is that private companies have gotten better access to bank credit, particularly over the last 10 years and maybe even more so over the last 5 years. For the last 3 years, private companies have borrowed roughly twice as much as state companies from the banking systems. They have gotten much better access to credit, and it's not surprising. If you have a much, much higher return on assets, you have a better ability to repay loans. Banks can see this, so they are much more willing to lend to private companies today than they had been 10 or 20 years ago.
Does this put some unique pressures on the state-owned companies to perhaps perform better or streamline?
I think that's exactly right. I think, as I mentioned, in terms of output, the share of companies in the manufacturing sector that are state-owned, their contribution has gone down. And this is now extending to other kinds of companies, for example, in the mining sector, which includes oil and gas. We see Sinopec, which is one of the three big state national oil companies. They have a very inefficient operation, and they're now proposing one of the biggest privatizations that has ever occurred in China. They're proposing to sell off a third of their ownership in their downstream distribution system. In my view, this is really unheard of. Big state companies have never, ever sold off chunks of their businesses in order to raise funds. Yet that's what we're seeing in one of the most heavily monopolized sectors of the economy.
Does this perhaps reflect a growing trend that maybe the government is finding these state-owned companies to be a bit unwieldy to control, and maybe it's better left to the forces of the market and private sector?
Well, I do think that the new leadership, President Xi Jinping and Premier Li Keqiang, have a pretty acute sense of the extent to which many of these state-owned companies, are a very significant drag on China's economic growth. And if the funds that they are able to invest were reallocated to the more efficient private sector, China would grow more rapidly. There are many people who believe, and I think I would be one of them, that if they don't push some of these economic reforms through, there is a significant risk that the growth could slow down to 6% or 5% or even less. China has a tremendous opportunity to sustain very high economic growth if it would liberalize in the services sector, where there are regulations that prohibit the entry of private firms. There's a tremendous potential for improving the productivity in the services sector, and that will potentially contribute to the ability to maintain relatively high rates of economic growth over the next 5 to 10 years. I think if we haven't learned anything else about China over the recent decades, it is that the Chinese Communist Party and its leaders are depending on their success in driving the economy forward in order to stay in power. And I think Mr. Xi and Mr. Li understand this better than most, and they are going to push through some very significant economic reforms because they see the alternative is very, very frightening from the point of view of maintaining the Chinese Communist Party in control.
Nicholas Lardy has been closely watching economic trends in China for nearly 50 years. The senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics is the author of numerous books on China, including his just released title, Markets Over Mao. We're just about ready to release our latest version of The World News. It's coming up next with Steve Norman and International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for joining us today on Daybreak Asia.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on the Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com.